You know, some people enjoy composing their own music, chord by chord, and others are happiest when they come across that one perfect song. Work is not a lot different than that. Whether you prefer building your own workflow or using a pre-made template, with Monday.com, you and the team can work in a way that's comfortable for everyone. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com and build your own amazing workflow, or find an awesome template. No judgment.
Welcome back, everyone, to 1001 Heroes, Legends, Histories, and Mysteries Podcast. This is your host, John Hagedorn, and it's great to be with you today. We have covered a number of unsolved mysteries here at 1001 Heroes, but never one as powerfully moving as that of the true fate of Amelia Earhart. I'm usually not drawn toward government conspiracies, such as who killed JFK, or did the 1969 moon landing really happen? But I am old enough and wise enough to know that when the government wants to hide something, they can do a very thorough job of it, as they did in 1947, when one or more alien crafts with occupants crashed near Roswell, New Mexico. Or in 1937, when Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan's Electra crash-landed on a reef in the Marshall Islands, where they tried for 6 days to radio for help and were heard by officials on the island of Nauru, radio personnel on the HMS Achilles, Pan Am radio stations on Wake and Midway Islands, and Macapoo Point. And those transmission copies were later seized by Naval Intelligence, and by dozens of other radio stations which had been designated to receive her frequencies, along with a wide assortment of ham radio enthusiasts in places like Kentucky, Maine, Florida, Texas, California, and Canada, some of whom wrote down the details of Earhart's distress calls. And those details and dates match. This was the days before internet and cell phones. The official Navy position on Earhart, following a long and exhaustive search for her plane, is that Earhart and her navigator Noonan ran out of gas, ditched their plane in the ocean after not being able to land at their designated refueling point at Howland Island, and their plane, along with their bodies, lies at the bottom of the Pacific. End of story. Except for the long trail of witnesses who saw a very alive Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan picked up by a Japanese fishing boat, transferred to a larger boat in Jabor, where they were given medical treatment, then taken to Japanese headquarters on the island of Imige, transferred to Kwajalein, then to Truk, then flown to Saipan, where they both died brutally in Japanese captivity. All along that path they were seen and talked about in hushed whispers, because to say anything to anyone, the people knew, would bring quick execution from the Japanese. The Japanese had been building military bases in the Marshalls and other islands in flagrant violation of a treaty they had signed years previously, and they jealously prevented anyone who was not authorized to see, photograph, or talk about what they were doing. In the Marshall Islands, yachts and other vessels were boarded and searched for radios and photographic equipment, and these were removed by force if necessary. The Japanese were building up for war. They were on a full war footing on July 2, 1937, when Earhart, in her plane equipped with cameras, flew over the heavily fortified Marshall Islands. The Japanese attacked the mainland of China soon after picking her up on July 7, 1937. There was absolutely no doubt that they, the Japanese, considered she and Noonan to be on a spying mission for the U.S. Navy, which desperately was seeking proof at that time of what bases the Japanese were building in the Pacific Islands. The U.S. government had helped to finance her round-the-world flight. Officially or unofficially, they knew she could gather important information on her final leg from Papua New Guinea to the west coast of the U.S. It is still very possible that she was told under no circumstances should she attempt to go out of her flight path, and the Marshall Islands are 700 miles north of where she was supposed to land, Howland Island. Yet radio signals received by the Coast Guard, Pan Am radio direction finders, the Navy, and others indicated that her distress signals came from 281 degrees north of Howland, putting her right at Mealy Atoll in the Marshalls, solidly in Japanese waters. And as you might expect, the Japanese refused to allow our planes to search there. And 7 years later, orders came down to all military intelligence officers to, quote, be on the lookout for any word concerning Amelia Earhart, end quote. Any proof of her existence would, of course, be locked away, because by that time, Franklin Delano Roosevelt had issued orders to seal her files. In the book The Earhart Enigma by Dave Horner, he writes, on May 13, 1938, a call came in during Secretary Morgenthau's Treasury meeting. It was from Mrs. Roosevelt's office, and because the meeting was official, the call was transcribed. Eleanor Roosevelt's personal secretary, Melvina Schneider, answered, oh, hello, Tommy. How are you? This letter that Mrs. Roosevelt wrote me trying to get the report on Amelia Earhart. Now, I've given a verbal report. If we're going to release this, it's just going to smear the whole reputation of Amelia Earhart. Yes, if we give it to this one man, we've got to make it public. We can't let one man see it. And if we ever release the report of the Itasca on Amelia Earhart, the reputation she's got is gone. Now, I know what the Navy did, and I know what the Itasca did, and I know how Amelia absolutely disregarded her orders. And listeners, there's much more to that transcription. There is a mountain of circumstantial evidence out there which proves that Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan, her navigator, did not crash and sink in the Pacific. The most compelling evidence to me is what they call the post-lost radio transmissions, Amelia's cry for help, heard by radio operators sometimes thousands of miles away, as well as the little-known story of the message in the bottle. Today, we'll share those stories and stories of regular people not affiliated with the government in any way, who heard Amelia's pleas for help and wrote down what they heard, and then took the huge next step to report it to the people they trusted to do something about it. The saddest part of the Earhart saga is that although coordinates were given and the information was clear that Earhart was still alive, nothing was done to help her, and her story was officially buried. That is a lasting shame on our national conscience. We'll talk about Dave Horner's book, The Earhart Enigma, and much more in this conversation with Chasing Earhart director Chris Williamson right after these sponsor messages. Welcome back, everyone, to 1001 Heroes, Legends, Histories, and Mysteries podcast. A close contact of mine who I've worked with in the past, and a man who probably knows as much about Amelia Earhart and her disappearance as any man alive, is Chris Williamson, author of Rabbit Hole, project director of the Chasing Earhart Project, and a man who's always in the center when it comes to questions about Earhart. There is a mountain of circumstantial evidence that leads to the very tangible fact that Amelia Earhart survived her crash and did not crash her plane into the Pacific, where it was then lost. Many, many people believe that she survived. And like I said, there's a mountain of circumstantial evidence. And key among that evidence, to me, is what they call the post-lost radio transmissions.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you, John, for having me. It's an honor, as always, to be part of your show. I really appreciate everything you do for history. My name is Chris Williamson. As John mentioned, I'm the project director for Chasing Earhart. We have run probably about 120 podcasts exclusive to the Earhart legacy and disappearance. And we've been doing this for a long time. I'm also the founder of, or the co-host of Vanished, which is a really interesting podcast that my co-host Jen Taylor and I do. And as John mentioned, I wrote a book called Rabbit Hole a couple of years ago on Earhart with a second edition that's coming very soon. Just to give you like a little bit of an idea of why this matters, really, to be honest with you, is Earhart was an icon way ahead of her time, probably 100 years ahead of her time, at least. You know, she was a woman who was a woman of many hats. She became the face of women in aviation, for sure. I would dare to say really the face of aviation. You know, this happens, her stratospheric rise occurs about five-ish years after Lindbergh makes his world flight completion, circumnavigation. And they were her publicist, her eventual husband, and the gentleman who actually wrote or publicized Lindbergh's book, George Putnam, wanted a lady version, a Lady Lindy. He wanted his own version of a female version of Lindbergh. And in walks Earhart. Everything sort of falls into place, and she becomes this icon really quick. She goes on a couple of transatlantic flights and just takes the entire planet by storm. And people just fall in love with her persona. She becomes America's sweetheart. This is a very big oversimplification, but her career is not that long before she decides that she wants to do one final flight around the world. It is on record as her final stunt flight, long distance stunt flight, before she retires and probably continues her relationship with Purdue, which was only about a year and a half old at the time she disappears. And that's what takes us to July 2nd, 1937. As John mentioned early at the top of the show, her last flight, her last takeoff from Ley, New Guinea. She worked really closely with Guinea Airways. And she disappeared, basically. You know, we're at a point now where her and Noonan vanish off the face of the earth, somewhere in the vicinity of Howland Island, according to the final radio transmission calls. But of course, those final radio transmission calls are in dispute because we now have these post-loss radio signals, which basically post-loss just means after the fact. So the idea that she went down or didn't in the water or somewhere close to on Nicomoro Island or in the Marshall Islands, take your pick, wherever it goes, these post-loss radio signals do occur. And that's what we're here to basically talk about. There are a couple of really noted examples, really famous examples of notes and post-loss radio signals that were recorded, a bunch of hoaxes, and a bunch that are undeterminate origins to this day. So that's where we're at.
Yeah, thank you, Chris. There were receiving locations, official receiving locations, be it radio stations, Coast Guard stations, Navy transmitters, Pan Am transmitters, set up everywhere from the West Coast to the U.S., out through the Pacific Islands. And many of those, she went down July 2nd, 1937.
That's right.
And yes, a good portion of the English-speaking world was aware that her flight was in progress.
Yes.
Okay. Some were listening for the news, for any news. But many, starting on July 2nd, accidentally, as it seems, heard radio messages, distress calls from Amelia Earhart. Some of them put it down in their diaries. Others wrote it down as soon as they could remember everything they had to remember. And those people actually heard, very likely, the last words of Amelia Earhart. Would you start with telling us what you know about the post-loss transmissions and share some of those stories? And I can share some as well as we go forward.
Sure. Yeah. I'll let you tackle Nina Paxton. We'll definitely get into Nina. It's an interesting story. I will tell you that there are, you know, it's really interesting. There are, you know, competing, we all know there's competing theories in this case. There's competing camps. We have multiple theories, probably over a dozen, if we're being really honest, but four or five really big ones that seem to be competing over the last 88 years, we'll say now. We're pretty close to July now. So close enough to 88 years. And two of those main components or theories have diaries in them, and two women at the center of them that happened to have notebooks and could actually, you know, scribble down some stuff and actually put some stuff into some kind of a record of what they claim to have heard. The first is probably the more famous of the two. It's a 15-year-old girl. Her name is Betty Klink. And the post-loss radio signals really sort of are part of Tiger's, the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery, their attempt at trying to prove the idea that Earhart and Noonan happened across Gardner Island at the time, Nicomoro now. I'll give you just a brief rundown of that as quickly as I can, and then we'll get into it in detail. You know, the post-loss radio signals, they're baked into a larger theory. So they're supporting of what's called the castaway hypothesis. We'll get into Nina in a bit. This basically sets up into three parts, right? So this opens, of course, with July 2nd, 1937. Earhart and Noonan go missing. Their last confirmed transmission with the Coast Guard cutter Itasca, which was laying in wait off of Howland to assist them and coming in, takes place at 8:43 a.m. local time, Greenwich Mean Time. Of course, we now have the very famous call out, "We must be on you but cannot see you." The whole idea behind Castaway is that Earhart and Noonan, they fail to reach Howland, and they decide to continue south on the LOP, which is the line of position, until they come across Gardner Island. It was named Gardner at the time. It's been since named Nicomororo. Now, Earhart's able to put the plane down on the coral atoll there. It's big enough to take a landing. We don't know what condition the plane may have been in once landed, but we know for a time that radio distress calls were sent out and heard by, as John said, dozens of radio operators and radio stations in places all over the world. Now, some determined to be, as I said, hoaxes, some undeterminate, and some to be credible by Tiger and some other groups that are out there sort of searching for Earhart. These calls continue to occur. Here's the really neat part. They happen to occur within conjunction of low and high tides at Nicomororo. So for anyone who's heard this show, 1001 Heroes, they'll be familiar with how this goes. The engines on the Electra, they're needed to be in running order, and they need to be out of the water to power her radio. Now, the engines obviously could have been damaged on put down. You know, we don't know, but it happens according to low tide and high tide. This occurs really for several days until the tide, I guess, presumably becomes too much for the Electra, pulls it over the side down 16,000 feet and just gets trashed among the coral atoll off Howland. So that's basically a really oversimplification of the post-loss radio signals. They do happen for several days after, and it's really sort of a feather in the cap of Tiger, who has really sort of put this report out several years back on Earhart's birthday to sort of explain all of this.
As I see it, they were receiving calls from July 2nd, which was the day she went down, until July 7th.
Yeah, and 5 days. Yeah.
And the people who reported on this, at least the civilians who reported on this, almost to a person, said that Amelia said that she was caught on a reef. Apparently, Noonan was suffering from a concussion, and he was acting very strangely, insisting on getting out of the plane, at time trying to struggle with Amelia for the controls. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. She was able to say that he had been wounded and that she only slightly. There was no doubt that in the daytime when they were trying to make those calls, there was heat and sun bearing down on that plane. No kind of air conditioning. It would have been very hot in that plane. And there was no doubt Noonan, feeling the way he was trying to get out, especially early on.
Yeah, they were in uncharted territory. You know, again, take your pick, whether you believe they were at Nicomororo or whether you believe they were in the Marshall Islands, it doesn't really matter. They were in a position, none of the theory that's posited out there puts Noonan in a good condition. Noonan was very discombobulated, for lack of a better term. If he really did hit his head on landing.
There were at least two persons who reported that Amelia had mentioned the Marshall Islands and at one point had mentioned Mealy Atoll.
Mm-hmm.
So the Mealy Atoll mentioned was Nina Paxton. I'm going to read you an article by Les Kenny. Les Kenny is one of those people with a background that's solid Amelia Earhart. He has researched everything along here. He's one of the most non-biased people that covered the Amelia Earhart story that I'm aware of. And when I talk about bias, I will mention personally, and it doesn't have to be Chris's opinion. I don't think it is. I will mention personally that Tiger, T-I-G-H-A-R, which is an association which we owe a lot to because they put a lot of information together regarding Amelia Earhart. But they are fixed on the belief that she went down on a reef or near the beach at Gardner Island, located about 400 miles southeast of Howland Island, which was Amelia and Fred Noonan's destination, whereas the Marshall Islands are located about 800 miles in a northerly direction. And it has been proven that they had enough gas to reach the Marshalls. I'm going to share portions of this article by Les Kinney about Nina Paxton. And I think you listeners will appreciate the honesty that she brings forth here. And it really adds to the credibility of this story. At about 2:20 in the afternoon of July 3rd, 1937, 41-year-old Nina Paxton was fiddling with the tuner on her Philco radio in Ashland, Kentucky, when she heard Amelia Earhart, K-H-A-B-Q, calling.
Close.
It is close. Yeah. What Chris is saying is that her real call numbers were K-H-A-Q-Q.
Yeah.
But it has been discovered that her first plane was K-H-A-B-Q, her call numbers. Mm-hmm. And that she was exhausted after this trip, probably tired, extremely stressed, and may well have used her earlier numbers. We're down here in the ocean on a little island, perhaps a coral reef at a point near Marshall Islands. For a few seconds, Nina attended to the needs of her 5-year-old son, Paul, thinking Miss Earhart must be on a training flight. When she realized Amelia was crying for help, she took a few notes. A few minutes later, Earhart was gone, and Nina Paxton would never be the same. On July 3, 1937, Nina had no idea where the Marshall Islands were located, nor did she know the call sign for Amelia Earhart's Lockheed Electra wasn't KHABQ. After hearing Earhart on her radio, Nina called the Ashland Police Department and then a nearby Coast Guard station. They laughed and said the call sign for Earhart's Electra was KHAQQ. Nina would never have known the call sign for Era's previous plane, a Lockheed Vega, was KHABQ. A tired, exhausted, worried, and emotionally drained, Amelia Earhart blurted out her old call sign. It would have been an easy thing to do. Nina was embarrassed, and the reason she didn't tell the local paper of Earhart's distress message until a week later. Les writes, "It took me 3 years and quite a bit of luck to locate the Paxton papers. Eventually, I found them at tiny Mars Hills University in the mountains of western North Carolina. They were donated to the university by a wife of a doctor who had worked with Nina in the 1950s. Nina Paxton's file had been collecting dust in a library storeroom since 1975. I plan to report the Paxton findings in the book I'm writing on the disappearance of Amelia Earhart. Recent events caused me to change my mind. Tiger just released a new post-lost radio study touting the claims of Betty Klink. Betty was 15 in 1937 and claimed to have heard Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan over a period of several hours on her home radio. According to Betty, she was doodling in her notebook, drawing sketches of movie stars, when she heard Earhart. But the down flyers never once gave their location. According to the jottings in Betty's notebook, Amelia seemed to be more concerned what was in her closet back home in North Hollywood, California. None of the other 56 post-lost radio messages collected by Tiger gives a location where Amelia and Fred went down.
Yep.
The Paxton papers tell us Earhart and Noonan landed in the Marshall Islands. Since Mars Hill University recently decided to put a few of Nina Paxton's letters on the internet, I decided it was time to share my findings. After hearing Amelia, and when time permitted, Nina stood vigil over her radio through the rest of July and into August of 1937. Occasionally, she picked up a few garbled words, but she was never sure it was Earhart. For the next several days, she tried to remember the 300 or 400 words she thought Amelia spoke, and then put them in sequential order. On July 22nd, Nina wrote to Mrs. Noonan, and on the 30th sent a letter to George Putnam, Amelia's husband. Both letters contained an attached message. The message was the compiled notes Nina had later typed while listening to Earhart on July 3rd, 1937. "This is an SOS, KHABQ calling. We are down here in the ocean on a little island, perhaps a coral reef, at a point near Marshall Islands." At that point, Earhart's voice must have been fading in and out as Nina wrote, "Directly northeast of a part of Marshall Islands, 90, unintelligible, 173 longitude and 5 latitude. Nina Paxton was the only one, I'll add this, that gave exactly the latitude and longitude.
That's
and by
right.
The way, both of those line up at Meliadhall in the Marshall Islands.
Mm-hmm.
You won't find that in any of the Tiger articles. Nina then recorded what she thought Earhart was saying. "We missed our course yesterday and came up here. We can see a part of Marshall Islands in daytime." And notice, by the way, she said up here, meaning probably north.
Yeah.
"There are no trees here, but we can see a few small trees on a part of Marshall Islands in daylight." Nina didn't hear every word Earhart uttered. In an early letter to George Putnam, dated August 5th, 1937, Nina described the Marshall Islands as Marshall Island and gave Earhart's locations as 173 longitude, 5 latitude. It is doubtful Nina heard there were no trees here unless Earhart was describing the reef at low tide with an island close by. Nina's letters conveyed honesty. If she wasn't sure of what she heard, she said so. In her first letter to Putnam, she wrote, "Since hearing her so well on Saturday, July 3rd, I have heard a few sentences at times that could have been K-H-A-Q-Q," and in a letter to Congressman Vinnison on August 12th said, "Sunday, August 8th at 10:15, I heard the word Earhart and a few sentences which I could not understand other than the sound Mateau on 12 megacycles." In a third letter to George Putnam, dated September 20th, 1937, Nina said, "Since July 3rd, I have heard sentences at various times which may have been K-H-A-Q-Q, but nothing of importance, unless they were K-H-A-Q-Q." So yeah. That's the important part of what Nina Paxton gave us, which is hugely important to those who believe it was the Marshall Islands and Mealy Atoll.
Mm-hmm.
Your feeling on that, Chris?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. It revolves around a series of alleged radio transmissions, you know, received by Nina Paxton, claiming to receive those intercepted distress calls from Earhart after the disappearance, very similar in nature to Betty, right? I mean, she jotted some things down. Betty jotted some things down in a notebook. It's almost competing, dueling eyewitnesses or ear witnesses, as we like to call them on the show. So they're hearing things, not seeing anything, of course. You know, it's interesting. The United States government, their official explanation is that the Electra just ran out of gas. And, you know, that's something that we can't, you know, I won't discount, because I that happens to contain the last radio calls, confirmed radio calls from Earhart, and that obviously all the very famous things that she says: "We must be on you, but cannot see you. Gas is running low, flying at 1,000 feet. There's probably half a dozen others. This is interesting with Nina, though, because of course, the U.S. government, you know, their official stance on this is that, you know, they were skeptical. People started questioning sort of Nina's, you know, authenticity of the transmissions, of her reporting the transmissions, the reliability of her equipment, you know, the veracity of her accounts, you know, what she was saying, was it true or not? And I think that's really interesting in and of itself, because you see a lot of that in Japanese capture. Japanese capture happens to put an awful lot of weight on eyewitness testimony. In this case, it's one step down. It's an ear witness testimony. But you look at these two things and you just sort of see a pattern. You see a lot of these people saying, like, look, this is what I heard. This is who I saw. It is what it is. But the U.S. government sort of, you know, poo-pooed that and just thought, you know, hey, she wasn't in the Marshalls. That's not what happened. You know, all of the things that your listeners will be familiar with. The U.S. government and a lot of the folks that believe other than Marshall Islands supporters believe that, you know, she couldn't have possibly made it to the Marshalls. The gas wasn't there. The ability wasn't there. There's all these different things. And so I find it interesting that her stuff is just sort of like poo-pooed and it's just sort of dismissed without any real serious investigation, which I think, you know, I think Japanese capture, there's a lot of things in that, under that hypothesis, under that umbrella, that could use some further looks, much more detailed, much more non-critical looks, you know, nuanced, but non-critical for sure. So there's a lot of that scattered evidence and information throughout Japanese capture. It's just sort of like the same as a lot of the other stuff.
We'll return with our interview with Chris Williamson, project director of Chasing Earhart, right after these sponsor messages. Back at you, Chris. You know, a lot of things do link together that couldn't possibly be hoaxes or couldn't possibly be thought of after the fact. I'll give you some great examples. It was within a week after July 2nd, 1937, that Japan invaded China. Within a week. So Japan was on a war footing and had been for some time. They didn't want anybody messing around anywhere near where they had bases. One of those places was the Marshall Island.
Japan basically came out and said, hey, we'll search. Like, we'll take care of it. We'll join your search. We will. And it's interesting, because that's a lot of times people that don't believe in the Japanese capture hypothesis or anything related to that. Hey, it's impossible. I mean, Japan even offered to help search. You know, there's no way that they would be holding her and helping search for her at the same time, right? Well, we know that that is not only possible, but it's likely in that scenario. And, you know, they, depending on who you believe and depending on who you talk to, they didn't know who they had in custody right away, right at the beginning. Some people believe that they absolutely knew exactly who they had right away as soon as they landed, as soon as they got into custody with them. They knew who she was. They knew who Noonan was. So, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, that whole thing is very interesting. And Japan is, you know, to this day, they say they didn't have her in custody. They never did. And it's one of those things where, if you believe any of this at all, to steal a line from Astonishing Legends, it's one of those situations where, like, you have to sort of buy into all of it. You can't just believe parts of it. It's an entire story. It's not just one piece. So, yeah, they, to answer your question very long-windedly, they did want to make sure they were the ones that searched in their areas and their waters, and that they obviously put some folks in the way of helping to search for Earhart. The overall search, it was a big part too.
And here's another link. The people who recorded what they heard from Amelia's distress calls all recorded that Noonan had been injured. In one way or another, they said he'd been injured. Lots of people said that. Amelia was able to get that message out there and get that across. There were no hoaxers providing different types of stories, like they were floating in a life raft or actually on an island or trying to survive on an island or anything like that. They were all consistent. Okay. Yeah. Noonan had been injured. She had been slightly injured. Okay. He probably with a head injury, judging by his actions. Okay. And I think, in fact, I think it was mentioned he had a head injury in at least one of those transmissions.
Yeah. Right? Billimon obviously, very famously attended to Noonan's head injury as well.
Yeah. The guy who was asked to attend to Noonan's injuries when the two were brought back to Jollywood Island tended to Noonan's head and leg injuries. He had hurt both his head and his leg, and said that Melia, as the people on shipboard called her, Melia's injuries were light. Mm-hmm. So that ties in the fact that he was injured ties in with the post loss transmissions as they were translated. And then later on the island of Jollywood. And there were a number of eyewitnesses on Jollywood, of whom Billimon Amaron was definitely very, very credible.
He's a big one. Yeah, he's a big one. He actually comes in contact with Earhart and Noonan. He has no idea who they are. He's not really he's not knowledgeable on the world flight. He doesn't really know what's going on when it comes to that. But he does, in great detail, talk about attending to Noonan's injuries and what those injuries were. I mean, he was a medic. That's something that would have been in his wheelhouse to do. It makes sense that he would have been the kind of guy they would have brought out to attend to an injury of that nature in that situation. And he, you know, what's really interesting about the Marshall Islands and Saipan and over 200 eyewitnesses that are all over the place, right? And in all different, you know, levels of the government and the military and locals that were on the island and, you know, the US military after the fact. It's interesting because none of those reports have drastically changed over the years. They're all pretty tight. When you look at the eyewitness testimony, you're thinking about, you know, you're looking at something that's 88 years ago now. So at the time that a lot of these folks were recorded, it was probably, you know, 40, 50 years later. That's a long time. Tell me what you did on July 2nd, 1995 at 10 a.m. in the morning. Could you tell me that in detail? Probably not. You might be able to tell me if it was a really interesting occurrence or a big day. You might be able to tell me some a summary of that day or some details, but for you to be able to come out 40, 50 years later and tell me exactly what it was and to remember that flawlessly, you know, you have to sort of give a little bit of grace there when it comes to that type of stuff. But even having said that, a lot of those reports and a lot of the big ones, especially Billimon and a lot of the other folks that came in contact, claimed they came in contact with Earhart and Noonan, those reports didn't differ, even on their deathbeds, they didn't differ. And so I think you have to sort of look at that as as adding some credibility to it. They weren't making stuff up. They weren't moving stuff around. It was pretty much, this is what happened. We know like we know because we were there and so were they. And so you look at that and it's really compelling when it comes to something like this that ties into post-loss after the fact, as we talked about in the beginning. And then of course, all of those eyewitness testimony occurring after the fact as well. You know, it kind of helps, it fits. And Nina Paxton's information, her longitude, latitude, her coordinates happen to line up with where all of these 200 plus eyewitness testimony, you know, segments come from. It's interesting. It's compelling. And like I've always said, the Japanese capture hypothesis is probably the most compelling of all of them when it comes to just the sheer amount of data that's out there to support it. And a lot of people would say to disprove it. But I mean, it just depends on what you fall down on. And I think that's where the fun can be.
One other thing we haven't mentioned today, but we have talked about it in the past, is the message in a bottle, which I thought was a fascinating, fascinating account. I never told you this, Chris. I got a letter from Sean Keats. I think you might have too.
He's a good friend.
Oh, yes. Good.
Yes,
and
he's a good
guy. Of course,
guy.
Regarding Amelia Earhart, Message in a Bottle, he said, I re-listened to the Vanished Amelia Earhart podcast over the weekend.
Cool.
Specifically, the two Japanese capture episodes. Thank you both for fine content.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. In listening to the podcast, it was apparent that neither of you had read The Earhart Enigma by Dave Horner.
Oh, well, yes, I have. Yes, I have.
While the entire book is quite fascinating, I would point you to the extensive research on the message in the bottle that begins on page 245. Many of your questions are answered here. As it happens, I have spare copies of this book, so I'm sending copies to both of you.
Very cool. That'll be my second copy of it. I know. I mean, yeah, Earhart Enigma is a great book. Yeah, Sean's a great guy, and he's I would encourage people to read the Earhart Enigma. It covers a lot of really the majority of the case. It's one of those, it's kind of like Ledger Domain, one of those books that really kind of goes over a lot of the content. Rabbit Hole joins that ranks now, I would hope, that goes over really the whole case in its entirety. The whole idea of the message in a bottle, it's my favorite piece of information from the entire, I don't care what theory, it's the best piece of information in all the Earhart case. It's so cool. And if this were to be, if there was ever to be any kind of credibility to this letter, or to this message in a bottle, it would just, the mind reels. You know, the idea that this bottle washes up, and it happens to have a message, from this guy who is a fellow, he's a fellow prisoner in one of the, that whole story, and the fact that it. I've read the Earhart Enigma. I knew David Horner. He was a great guy. An amazing guy. And I think he did probably the most complete study on that particular piece of evidence, but it's so shrouded in mystery. There's a lot more you could do. And it's going to be a very long, lengthy process because we just don't have much on that letter. But I can tell you that there are people that are looking at that letter as we speak, that are doing research on it to try to determine anything more that can be determined or pulled from that letter. So we're on it. It's just a matter of time at this point.
Listeners, I'm going to fill you in on what Dave Horner wrote in that book, The Earhart Enigma, about the message in the bottle. And here's what he wrote. Genevieve's discovery. The date was October 30th, 1938. Of course, at that time, there were very few people alive on Earth who might have thought that Amelia Earhart had somehow survived up to that point.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're talking about hoaxes, you can forget it.
At this point, yeah.
The place was the beach of Sulac-sur-Mer, and I know I'm saying that wrong, Gironde, France, a quaint seaside resort town serving the major wine-producing region around Bordeaux. Located on France's western coast, south of the Gironde River's entrance from the Atlantic, at 9 kilometers below Pointe de Grave, Sulac-sur-Mer has been a fashionable vacation resort since the early 20th century. Had our little bottle not washed up upon the beach of Sulac-sur-Mer, it may well have been swept into the swift waters of this great river to become marooned unceremoniously among the mud and assorted riverbank vegetation of the inland river, never to be found. The time on this particular fall afternoon was about 5 p.m. While strolling along the beach, 37-year-old Genevieve Barat spotted something bobbing in the shallow surf. It appeared to be a small bottle, and it was being pushed shoreward by the incoming tide. High tide that evening was at 9:35 p.m., according to the French Naval Hydrographic Oceanographic Office. She took a few steps into the shallow water and plucked the bottle from the waves. Examining the contents, she could see several pieces of paper along with a lock of light brown hair. The bottle was about 10 centiliters in size, about 6 cubic inches, or perhaps 3.5 inches high, including the neck, and 1.75 inches in diameter. This small bottle had been sealed with a cork and coated with wax, suggesting that someone had gone to a lot of trouble to protect the items inside. The neck of the glass bottle was wrapped and glued in aluminum foil. On the underside of the bottle was the imprint VB2. Overcome by curiosity, Genevieve stripped away the foil covering and freed the cork stopper to expose the contents it had so admirably protected. Ever so gingerly, she extracted first one piece of tightly rolled paper and then a second and a third. She unfolded one of them and read, "Have been a prisoner at Jaluit, in parentheses, Marshals, by Japanese. In prison of Jaluit, have seen Amelia Earhart, aviatrix, and in another jail, her mechanic, man, as well as other detainees. Bring this message immediately to the gendarmerie, so we shall be saved. Genevieve Barat had just become the first person in the Western world to learn the fate of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan. The barracks of the brigade of the Sulac de Mer Gendarmerie Nationale was only a few blocks away. Genevieve turned in her find and signed up on the bottle and its contents. As she reported in her official statement shortly afterward, I saw a bottle floating in the waves. Inside there were three pieces of paper and a lock of hair. Since one of these papers specified that the gendarmerie should be notified, I'm giving all of this to you. 40-year-old Felix Dorth was the designated official on duty when Genevieve arrived at the gendarmerie door. He became the second Westerner to learn the truth. It would be Gendarme Dorth's responsibility to officially document Genevieve's discovery in the process verbal number 139 de la Brigade, due 30th October 1938. The time of the report was 17:15 p.m.
Wow. Yeah, that's an amazing... The whole story is really amazing. And, you know...
I'll say this. He goes deep into the contents of the bottle, and it reveals quite a bit.
It does. It does reveal quite a bit. Yeah, the whole idea of them coming into getting this is really, you know, I don't know. I have thoughts about it. I feel like, look, if this happens, it's a 100 million to 1. That's 100 million to 1 that this would actually, you know, actually function and work. But again, you pull out that bottle, you look at the detail, and you look at what was written there. That kind of information could really only come from somebody who was in the know. You could think, okay, they're just totally making it up. But then comes the hair, the lock of hair and stuff like that. That's and the great detail that they're talking about. And the explanation for which he gives for why he's there is really important too, because you could have just scrapped all that and could have just been like, hey, I'm here next to Earhart, come send help. But he decides to go into more detail and give a more plausible, believable story, because he probably knows as he's writing that letter that whatever is in this letter has to be enough to convince somebody to come get us. And I think that's why he probably chose to incorporate Earhart into it so much, because, hey, we got your lost aviatrix over here. You know, not only are you going to come rescue me and, you know, and get me out of here, but you're going to get basically a prize, which is, you know, if you come get me, you're also going to get Earhart and Noonan too. And I think that's a really, you know, that whole story is just, it's incredible. It's like right out of a movie.
His story, listeners, involved him sailing his yacht into Jaluit for business reasons. And his yacht was seized by the Japanese because they had heavy security there. They didn't want anybody with any kind of radio capability anywhere in the Marshalls. And they were looking over that very, very closely. His yacht came in. They inspected it. They found a radio. Apparently, he and his men put up a fight, and the Japanese killed three of his Maori crewmen. He had three Maori crewmen. The Japanese killed them all and then put him in prison.
Right. He was the only one left. Yeah.
So now he's been taken by the Japanese, and they put him to work on one of their coal steamers down in the coal fire room. And he knew he didn't anybody. If you research what it's like working in one of those steamers in one of the coal rooms, those guys did not live long.
No.
And when they could, they ended their life by jumping overboard as soon as they could. It was that bad. Your life term in one of those boiler rooms was basically just months. Yeah. He knew he didn't have long left. He knew the ocean pretty well because he had taken his yacht everywhere along the ocean, knew the Atlantic coast very well, knew when that Japanese steamer was sailing where the tides would carry his bottle, and managed to somehow drop that bottle overboard. Maybe when he jumped with it.
Maybe. It's amazing for it to find its way there. Is really remarkable. And it's one of those scenarios where, you know, if it's got the potential to be the biggest bombshell of the entirety of the case, if it's ever determined that it's, hey, this is actually a legitimate thing. You know, once we determine what happened to Earhart and Noonan, and I say once we do, because I believe we will, you know, if it is Japanese capture, and if a lot of that, a lot of the FOIA requests that Les Kinney was denied of, if those get made public, you know, we're working on that as well on our side. Mm-hmm. You know, if that happens, I think you could start seeing a lot of information come out about a lot of pieces of evidence in this case under Japanese capture. And maybe we'll get really lucky and we'll have some more information come forth about the bottle and the bottle's origins, maybe a subsequent investigation into those origins or the veracity of the claims made in the bottle. There's so much stuff that you could really, it's so juicy. You could dive into that a lot, I think, with those FOIA requests.
That the story on that bottle, by the way, was found in the National Archives, and it was given security clearance by the Navy. I believe was it Les Kinney who found it?
I don't know if it was Les Kinney who found that or who uncovered that original story or not. I know Les Kinney's uncovered and found a lot, so I wouldn't be surprised if that was one, but I can't off the top of my head remember if he was the one that uncovered in a bottle. But I know that there's Yeah, there's a lot of stuff out there, and I know that Les Kinney's uncovered a lot of it, so I wouldn't be surprised.
I will tell you, listeners, again, The Earhart Enigma by Dave Horner contains pages and pages and pages of his research on this message in a bottle story, including numerous trips over to France to find out if they could, to find any information about this guy and where he came from and the ship that he owned, the yacht that he owned. He has really gone deep in all these pages. It's a fantastic story. I'm not going to give it all up here. And Dave has no idea that I'm pitching his book for him, but it was such a good book. I really can't help. It's an awesome piece.
Yeah, Dave. That book, The Earhart Enigma, is amazing. I would say if you want to, there's four books I think that you should probably go out and get if you really want to start the Earhart story. I mean, you're going to go different ways depending on what you feel and what you believe. But go get The Earhart Enigma by Dave Horner. Go get East of the Dawn by Susan Butler if you want to know all about the legacy and why this matters so much 100 years almost later. Go get The Truth at Last, Mike Campbell's book, if you want to read that. And then go get, Elgin Long's book, Amelia Earhart, The Mystery Solved, because that's foundational, right? So you got to start with that. This is the official United States explanation for what happened to her. So you start foundationally and then you walk out the way you want to, depending on, you know, where you've, what you feel happened and all that stuff. And that's what Chasing Earhart does. That's what Vanish does. It's trying to inspire folks to go out and like, hey, go do your own research here. Don't take my word for it or John's word for it or anybody's word for it. Go out there, do your own research, do your stuff, you know, get your, get into the little rabbit holes you want to get into. And, you know, when people do that, we get information like what Dave uncovered in The Earhart Enigma. You know, we get people that dig into these things and, you know, like Chris Hare and like Sean Keats and like all these other great guys that are out there that are doing this work, that dig into this stuff. Liz Smith just was on the show. She, you know, represented the Dateline theory. Something she came up with was just really, really incredible. And, you know, you look at all these things and people are taking the Earhart story and they're digging into little nuances and little trenches, and they're kind of going and figuring out, you know, what happened in these little things. And that's sort of the beauty of this case. There's so much information. You can pick a theory and just go to town. I don't care what you believe personally. It doesn't matter to me. I don't lose any sleep over that at night. But what I will tell you is that, you know, if you believe Japanese capture, I mean, go start with Mike Campbell's book. Absolutely. When Les Kinney's book comes out, go grab that. That guy's the encyclopedia on Earhart. There's nobody on the face of the earth knows more about Earhart than Les Kinney does. You know, there's a lot of really fantastic books on Japanese capture that you can go, you know, go check out at your local library, or go purchase on Amazon or something like that. But I mean, you know, there's so many great
ones. And Chris is being modest. He's got a very detailed volume on Earhart called Rabbit Hole. So that's another book you can look for. He's also got the podcast Chasing Earhart. And I can tell you that there's two very rare interviews on Mike Campbell that you'll find at 1001 Heroes.
Yes. Yes, I was very jealous. I'll tell you that. If we can just talk podcasting, Mike will know if he listens to the show. I will tell Mike. I will speak to Mike. Mike, you have an open invitation for Chasing Earhart anytime you want. You are the most requested guest by far. I can't tell you how many times I've had people say, "Why haven't you had Mike Campbell on your show? Are you avoiding the truth?" Look, not for lack of trying. I have tried to get Mike on the show. You know, hopefully we'll get lucky one day and he'll decide to finally, you know, give in and come on the show. But your piece with Mike was fantastic. And I listened to that a few times and it was really good. You did get a really rare interview and kudos to you for that. And that just goes to show you how good your show is. So kudos.
Thank you, Chris. Tell us a little bit about your book, Rabbit Hole.
Okay, sure. Hey, well, thank you for that. So Rabbit Hole's got a second edition coming out that's going to be even longer, if you can believe it. It came out a couple of years ago, and it was really birthed out of an idea of people wanting to have a written transcript of what's now season one of Vanished, which is all about Amelia Earhart. We did 16 episodes there, probably close to 50 hours of content on Earhart alone, just in that 16 episode arc. And people had wanted a something tangible they can hold in their hand that they could read, because our audience tends to skew a little bit older and they like to read stuff. You know, I'm a big fan of books, so I totally agree. After enough of that, we decided to come up with Rabbit Hole, which was something I edited. It was like a 3 year long process of editing that original show. But what we decided to do is not just put out a written transcript of the show verbatim. We wanted to put extra stuff into it, to make sure that if you decided to consume the show that way instead of listening to it, you'd have a few extra bells and whistles. So Rabbit Hole's got 50 guests across the Earhart world and across the Earhart case. We cover everything from the cradle to the disappearance and the at the time 85 years after that. And you know, it's pretty complete. And we have a second edition coming out that's gonna have a whole new theory in it that we talked about in the show originally, wasn't in the first version of the book. And then we've also got some stuff, some little bells and whistles and some surprises for new folks who want to pick up the second edition. And that's gonna be out very soon. It's with Publisher now, and they will put it out soon. We'll have an ebook version of it, which is great. That'll come out finally. And then we'll see what people think of it. But it's up there. I mean, I think it's a good book if you want to go through the whole thing, if you want a good snapshot. I don't pretend to put it on the same plane as Earhart Enigma and Ledger Domain and Truth at Last and all those great books I just mentioned. But you know, it's our honest attempt, and I think the passion comes through. So yeah, pick it up. It's at Amazon right now, if their first edition is.
Chris, thank you so much for joining us today at 1001 Heroes. We appreciate it. I know my listeners enjoy having you on, and it's been great talking to you.
Yeah,
Anything comes
honor.
up, I'll call you or you call me, and we'll discuss it. Still a lot of rabbit holes for us to chase downward, too. So,
Absolutely, absolutely. Honored as always, John. Honored. Thank you.
thank you so much.